The Prime Minister's aide-de-camp had spelled Mark at the wheel of the rolls on the long stretch northwards from Bloemfontein. Mark had been able to sleep, hunched up on the front seat, oblivious of the lurching and shaking over the bad stretches of road, so that he woke refreshed when Sean Courtney stopped the little convoy on a deserted hilltop 15 miles south of the built-up complex of mines and towns of the Witwatersrand. It was late afternoon, and the lowering sun turned the banks of a low false cloud in the north to a sombre purple hue. It was not cloud, but the discharge from the hundreds of chimneys of the power stations and refineries, of the coal-burning locomotives and the open fires of tens of thousands of African labourers in their locations, and of burning buildings and vehicles. Mark wrinkled his nose as he smelled the acrid taint of the city, fouling the clean, dry air of the Highveld. The entire party took the opportunity to stretch cramped muscles and to relieve other physical needs. Mark noted wryly that nice social distinctions were observed when those members of the party who had general officer's rank and cabinet minister's status used the screen side of the parked cars, while the lesser members stood out in the open road. While they went about their business, there was an argument in progress. Sean was advocating caution and a roundabout approach through the suburbs and outlying areas of Johannesburg. "We should cut across to Standerton and come in on the Natal Road. The rebels are holding all the southern suburbs." "They'll not be expecting us, old Sean. We'll go through fast and be at Marshall Square before they know what's happened," Yanni Smuts decided. "I can't afford the extra 2 hours it will take us to circle around." And Sean growled at him. "You always were too damned hot-headed, Yanni. Good God, you were the one who rode into the Cape with 150 men in your commando to capture Cape Town from the whole British army." "Gave them the fright of their lives," the Prime Minister chuckled as he came around the back of the rolls, buttoning his trousers. And Sean followed him, went on with relish. "That's right, when you tried the same tricks on Leto von Vorbeck in German East Africa. You were the one who got the fright. He roasted your ass for you." Mark winced at Sean's choice of words, and the Prime Minister's party looked to heaven and earth, anywhere except at their master's suddenly unsmiling countenance. "We are going into Johannesburg on the Boysons Road," said Yanni Smuts coldly. "You'll be no damn good to us dead," grumbled Sean. "That's enough, old Sean. We'll do it my way." "All right," Sean agreed lugubriously. "But you'll ride in the second car. The Cadillac will lead with your pennant flying." He turned to the Prime Minister's driver. "Flat out, you understand. Stop for nothing."
"Yes, sir."
"Have you gentlemen got your music with you?" he demanded, and all of them showed him the sidearms they carried. "Mark," Sean turned to him, "get the Mannlicher off the roof." Mark unstrapped the leather case from the luggage rack and assembled the 9.3mm sporting rifle, the only effective weapon they had been able to find at short notice in Somerset House before leaving. He loaded the magazine and handed the weapon to Sean, then slipped 2 yellow packets of ammunition into his own pockets. "Good boy," Sean grunted and peered at him closely. "How are you feeling? Did you get some sleep?"
"I'm fine, sir."
"Take the wheel." Darkness fell swiftly, smearing the silhouettes of the blue gum trees along the low crests of the rolling open ground, crowding in the circle of their vision. There were the flickering pinpoints of open cooking fires from a few of the native shacks among the hills, but these were the only signs of life. The road was deserted, and even when they began to speed past the first brick-built buildings, there were no lights, and the stillness was unnatural and disquieting. "The main power station has shut down. The coal miners were limiting supply to 50 tons a day for essential services, but now they've stopped even that," the Prime Minister mused aloud, and neither of them answered him. Mark followed the twinkling red rear lights of the Cadillac, and the darkness pressed closer. He switched on the main beams of his headlights, and suddenly they were into the narrow streets of Boysons, the southernmost suburb of Johannesburg. The miners' cottages crowded the road like living and menacing presences. On the left, against the last faint glimmer of the day, Mark could make out the skeletal shape of the steel headgear at Crown Mine's main haulage, and ahead the low table-like hillocks of the mine dumps gave him a nostalgic twinge. He thought suddenly of Fergus MacDonald and Helena, and glanced once again to his left, lifting his eyes from the road for a moment. Just beyond the Crown Deep headgear, not more than a mile away, was the cottage on Lover's Walk, where she had taught him he was a man. The memory was too wrapped around with pain and guilt, and he thrust it aside and turned his full attention back to the road, just as the first rifle shots sparkled from the darkened cottage windows on the right side of the road ahead. Instantly he was judging the angle and field of the enemy fire, noticing how they had chosen the curve of the road where the vehicles must slow. Good, he thought dispassionately, applauding the choice, and he hit the gear lever of the rolls, double-D-clutching into a lower gear to build up revolutions for the turn. Get down, he shouted at his illustrious passengers. Ahead, the Cadillac swerved wildly at the volley, and then recovered and went roaring into the turn. 6 or 7 rifles, Mark estimated, and then saw the high hedge and the open pavement below the cottage windows. He would give them a changing, closing target, he decided, and used the power and rush of the rolls to broadside up onto the pavement under the cover of the hedge. Foliage brushed with a light rushing whisper against the side of the roaring vehicle, and behind him a service revolver banged lustily as Sean Courtney fired through the opening window. Mark hit the brakes and fanned the back of the rolls through the turn, bounding off the pavement, and let her sway out across the road to further confuse the riflemen in the cottages. Then he tramped down hard on the accelerator, gunned her through the turn, and went howling down into the dark, deserted commercial area of Boyson's, leaving the stupefied rifleman staring into the deserted bend and listening to the receding note of the Rolls-Royce engine. Only 2 miles and they would be through the danger area, over the ridge and into Johannesburg proper. Ahead of him, the Cadillac was running through the area of shops and warehouses and small factories, its headlights blazing harshly on the buildings that lined the road, carving a tunnel of light down their avenue to safety. In the back seat of the Rolls, the two generals had not taken Mark's advice to seek cover and were both sitting bolt upright, discussing the situation objectively in cool, measured tones. "That was quick thinking," Smuts said. "They weren't expecting that, Dern." "He's a good lad," Sean agreed. "But you are wasting your time with that pistol." "Oh, it gives me something to do," Sean explained as he reloaded the chambers of his revolver. "You should have ridden with my commando, old Sean. I would have taught you to save ammunition," Smuts sought revenge for Sean's earlier remarks. The headlights of the Cadillac tipped slightly upwards as it charged through the dip and reached the first rising ground. They all saw the roadblock at the same moment. It was flung up crudely across the road. Oil drums, balks of timber, iron bedsteads, sandbags, and household furniture obviously dragged from the cottages. Sean swore loudly and with ferocity. "I can turn now," Mark shouted, "but they'll get us when we slow down, and we'll have to go back through the ambush." "Watch the Cadillac," Sean shouted back. The heavy black machine had not hesitated, and it roared up the slope at the barricade, picking the spot which seemed weakest. "He's going to open the breach. Follow him, Mark." The Cadillac smashed into the roadblock, and tables and chairs flew high into the night. Even above the roar of wind and engine, Mark could hear the tearing, crashing impact, and then the Cadillac was through and going on up the ridge. But its speed was bleeding away, and a white cloud of steam plumed from the torn radiator. However, they had forged a breach in the barricade, and Mark steered for it, bumping over a mangled mass of timber and then accelerating away up the slope, gaining rapidly on the leading vehicle. The Cadillac was losing speed, clearly suffering a mortal injury. "Shall I stop for them?" Mark demanded. "No," said Sean. "We've got to get the Prime Minister." "Yes," said Smuts. "We can't leave them." "Make up your bloody minds," yelled Mark. And there was a stunned, disbelieving silence in the back, and Mark began to brake for the pickup. The machine gun opened from the scrubby bush at the base of the nearest mine dump. The tracer flailed the night, brilliant white fire sweeping down the road in a blinding storm. The high, ripping, tearing sound was unmistakable, and Mark and Sean exclaimed together in appalled disbelief. "Vickers!" The Prime Minister's green and golden pennant on the bonnet of the Cadillac drew the deadly sheet of fire, and in the horrified microseconds that Mark watched, he saw the car begin to break up. The windshield and side windows blew away in a sparkling cloud of glass fragments. The figures of the three occupants were plucked to pieces like chickens caught in the blades of a threshing machine. The Cadillac slewed off the road and crashed headlong into the blank wall of timber warehouse on the edge of the road. And still, the relentless stream of Vickers' fire tore into the carcass, punching neat black holes into the metalwork, holes that were rimmed with bare metal that sparked in the headlights of the rolls like newly minted silver dollars. It would only be seconds before the gunner swiveled his Vickers onto the rolls, Mark realised, and he searched the road ahead for a bolt hole. Between the timber warehouse and the next building was a narrow alleyway, barely wide enough to admit the rolls. Mark swung out to make a hay cart turn for the alley, and the gunner guessed his intention, but was stiff and low on his traverse as he swung the Vickers onto the rolls. The sheet of bullets ripped the surface of the road, a boiling, teeming play of dust and tarmac that ran down under the side of the car. Before the gunner could correct his aim, the petrol tank of the ruined Cadillac exploded in a woofing clap of sound and a vivid rolling cloud of scarlet flame and dense black smoke. Under its cover, Mark steered for the alleyway and slammed the rolls into it, although she was suddenly heavy on the steering and thumping brutally in her front end. 50 feet down, the alley was blocked with a heavy haulage trailer, piled high with newly sawn timber balks, and Mark skidded to a halt and jumped out. He saw that for the moment they were covered by the corner of the warehouse from the Vickers, but the timber trailer cut off their escape down the alley, and it would be only minutes before the strikers realised their predicament and moved the Vickers to enfilade the alleyway and shoot them to pieces. One glance showed him that machine gun fire had shredded the offside leading wheel. Mark jerked open the rear door and snatched the Mannlicher from Sean and paused only a moment to snap at the two generals. "Get the wheel changed. I'll try and hold them off." Then he was sprinting back down the alleyway. "I shall have to insist that in future when he gives me an order he calls me sir," Sean said with thin humour, and turned to Smuts. "Have you ever changed a wheel, Yanni?" "Don't be stupid, old Sean. I'm a horse soldier. And your superior officer," Smuts smiled back at him, with his golden beard looking like a refined Viking in the reflected headlights. "Bloody hell," grunted Sean. "You can work the jack." Mark reached the corner of the warehouse and crouched against it, checking the load of the Mannlicher before glancing around. The Cadillac burned like a huge pyre, and the stink of burning rubber and oil and human flesh was choking. The body of the driver still sat at the wheel, but the smoky red flames rushed and drummed about him so that his head was blackening and charring and his body twisted and writhed in a slow, macabre ballet of death. There was a wind that Mark had not noticed before, a fitful, inconstant wind that gusted and puffed down the ridge, rolling thick clouds of the stinking black smoke across the road, then changing strength and direction, so that for a few seconds the smoke pall once again poured straight upwards into the night sky. Over all blazed the flickering orange wash of the flames, uncertain light which magnified shadow and offered false perspective. Mark realised that he had to get across the road into the scrub and eroded ground below the mine dump before he could get a chance at the Vickers gunner. He had to cross 50 open yards before he reached the ground where he could turn the clumsiness and relative immobility of the Vickers to his own account. He waited for the wind. He saw it coming, rustling the grass tops in the firelight and rolling a dirty ball of newspaper down the road. Then it picked up the smoke and wafted it in a stinking black pall across the open roadway. Mark launched himself from the corner of the warehouse and had run 20 paces before he realised that the wind had tricked him. It was merely a gust, passing in seconds and leaving the night still and silent when it had gone, silent except for the snapping, crackling flames of the burning Cadillac. He was halfway across as the smoke opened again, and the cold weight of dread in his belly seemed to spread down into his legs and slow them as he ran like a man in shackles. But the battle clock in his head was running clearly, tolling off the seconds, judging finely the instant that the Vickers gunner up on the dump spotted his shadowy running figure, judging the time it took for him to swing and re-sight the heavy weapon. "Now," he thought, and rolled forward from the waist without checking his speed, going onto his shoulder and somersaulting, ducking under the solid blast of machine gun fire that came at the exact second he had expected it. The momentum of his fall carried him up onto his feet again, and he knew he had seconds before the unsighted gunner picked him up again. He plunged onwards, and lances of pain shot through the old bullet wounds in his back, wounds which had not felt in over a year. The pain was in anticipation, as well as from the wrench of his fall. The bank of red earth on the far side of the road seemed to loom far off, while instinct warned him that the Vickers was onto him again. He launched himself feet first like a baseball player sliding for the plate, and at the same instant the stream of Vickers bullets tore a leaping sheet of dust off the lip of the bank and the ricochets screamed like frustrated banshees and wailed away into the night. Mark lay under the bank for many seconds, with his face cradled in the crook of his arm, sobbing for breath, while the pain in his old wounds receded and his heart picked up its normal rhythm. When he lifted his head again, his expression was bleak, and his anger was cold and bright and functional.